So again, we are discussing Revelation chapter 13, beginning in verse 11, talking about the beast from the earth or the land that comes as a companion and support to the beast from the sea. The beast from the sea we identified about a month ago as being a great power that is secular in nature, that serves to oppress the people of God. We are told in verse 8 of the text, all who dwell in the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain from the foundation of the world. He had that ability to oppress the saints. Notice verse 7, make war with the saints to overcome them. The religious aspect of this is supported by the beast from the land, who we have already identified in other places as being, in actuality, the false prophet that is mentioned. The false prophet is mentioned in a number of different places in the book. Let me go back to the three locations that it's found. Chapter 16, verse 13, out of the unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. In chapter 19 and verse 20, where we are told that the beast and the false prophet would be cast alive into the lake of fire burning with brimstone. And then at the final defeat of Satan in chapter 20 and verse 10, the devil was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet are. And so when we talk about these two individuals or these two representations, we find one is secular in nature, the other religious, as we have read in verses 11 and 18 previously. The beast from the earth, we're told in verse 13, performs great signs. Verse 14, deceives those who dwell in the earth by the signs which he had the power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to those who dwell on the earth that they should make an image or an idol to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. And in verse 16, causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, that no one can buy or sell except the one who has the mark or the name of the beast, the number of his name 666. So you have a supportive circumstance here, where the beast of the earth supports the efforts of the beast from the sea to oppress the people of God and to cause and to exercise the power and dominion over all of the earth for a period of time. We will just note once again, as we talk about these two fearsome creatures that are described in this particular text and the power that they wield over the earth, we do want to emphasize both verse 10 of the text as well as verse 18 of the text indicate that their time in power will come to an end, which we will get to when we get into the 19th and 20th chapters of the book. So that's basically an overview of what we've discussed up to this point. As always, we want to look at the applications that can be made. So why? We talked about the why it was written. I want you to consider what it equips the people in the first century to know and to utilize as they seek to live for God in the midst or in the face of such evil. So notice, first of all, it gives them awareness of how these powers that exist that are oppressing them are working, that they both have that secular prong of attack, but also they have a religious prong of attack, that false religion which would deceive those on the earth, which would lead those on the earth to become antagonistic toward those who are righteous. Again, it's very much the way that it works today. We'll give as perhaps the most predominant example of this in our day and time is the conflict that exists between what is nominally referred to as Christianity and Islam. Again, recognize that what is nominally referred to as Christianity is not at all, but the Islamic extremists, the Muslim extremists desiring to destroy those who are the people of the book, they don't make a distinction between who is a faithful Christian and who's caught up in denominational error at all. But you have those individuals who have this view of religion that that the proper name for God is Allah, and that Muhammad is the prophet, and those who follow after Jesus are mistaken. And they defend that, some of them, by taking literally the writings of the Quran, and as such, in their interpretation of those, they call upon a jihad, or a holy war against those who oppose the prophet. Well, it leads to a great deal of persecution and oppression. The Coptic Christians in certain parts of the world are living in the shadow of the Islamic faith, and as a result of that, they lose their lives. They're oppressed even to death as a result of these things. So it'd be kind of a parallel to that we see in the first century. And if you take that later date and apply that to the Roman Empire, where you have emperor worship, and you have such influence to where the world falls under the thrall of that empire, the control of that empire, and you have a group that refuses to follow their lead, then problems happen. We of course have examples of that we could make allusion to prior to this first century application. I think, for example, with regard to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who refused to bow down before King Nebuchadnezzar and worship the image of the king. And as a result of that, they were thrown into a fiery furnace. You remember that Daniel, when the call was to cease the worship to their gods and to worship only the one God that was officially accepted, he went to his window and he continued to pray to God. And as a result of that, though he was a favorite of the king because the king's word was supreme, the king had to throw him into a den of lions. And of course, he didn't lose his life because God protected him, but that's an example. And when we talked about our postmodernism lesson in the first hour, you can use that issue that we talked about just to illustrate the point with regard to gender identity and the homosexual agenda that now has become more broadly stated as the LGBTQT plus agenda, that if you don't toe the line with regard to those and those who advocate for that, then again, you become oppressed. Fortunately, it's not physical persecution at this point in time, but certainly it's an intolerance for our fundamentalism and our audacity to say someone like that could be wrong. So these are the kinds of things that we're talking about. You've got the secular and you've got the religious that ties in, and as they became aware of this in this writing, again, I think there is a great deal of comfort to be found in verse 10 concerning the beast of the sea. That he who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. And then in verse 18 of the text, the number of the man is, or the number of the beast is the number of man, 666, which I believe in this particular passage would indicate a limit and a final end because God is victorious and the beast would fall short. Now, if you'll notice, I've got here the awareness and the awareness of the limited time and ultimate failure of the beast of the earth and the efforts of the beast of the earth and the beast of the sea, the beast of the sea and the beast of the earth to bring about this world power and this oppression and the destruction of God's people. To us, however, there are those general applications that can likewise be made, and we want to be aware of the effectiveness of false religion. I've heard many, many times in my preaching Christians come up to me after I've taught a simple lesson on baptism or a simple lesson on faith or a simple lesson on the nature of the church, the organization of the church, the work of the church, those kinds of things. And they'll say, you know, I just don't understand how anyone could misunderstand that. How anyone could, if you teach that, that they would reject it because it's so obviously true to the Word of God, so obviously so. And I always thank them for that, but I always think to myself, that they're just not getting it. that the power of God is salvation to all who believe, but to us, though it is the aroma of life, to many it is the aroma of death. And it has to do with their mindset, their viewpoint, their approach. And it is not something that is tenable to them. It's not something that they're going to be accepting of. And primarily that is because they have already accepted something else. It is very easy to be credulous of false claims, to be taken in by individuals who are teaching error and who are involved in false religion. and are told what is divine when it is in fact not divine. I guess we could give a scriptural parallel to that from the book of Acts in the 17th chapter. You'll remember where you have those in Thessalonica that sought to kill the Apostle Paul because he preached the truth, and so it was necessary for him to basically run for his life, and he went to the very next town, which was Berea. And we are told in Acts 17 and verse 11 that they were more fair-minded than those in Thessalonica. Why? Because they searched the scriptures daily to find out if the things spoken were so. So the difference between the two groups, they were two sets of Jews, but some were saying, no, we're Jews and we're only Jews and we don't care what you have to say. And the others were saying, okay, is what you're saying what God's word teaches? And they searched. And when they searched and found that it was truth, then they were amenable to it. But it is easy for individuals to be caught up in this. And perhaps one application we can make in that regard is our approach when we talk to people about it. We need to be patient. We need to be kind. We don't need to get in their face and say, you know, if you don't accept this, you don't believe this, and you're just an evil person. You're hard-hearted, and you're smart enough to know, but you're unwilling to. So you're just being willful or something like that in our approach to it. And all of those things may be so, but patience is needed, because often it takes time for individuals to set aside their prejudices or to be convinced otherwise. Because not everyone is as open-minded as they need to be eventually. But that danger is present, and that danger is something that is relevant to us. It is possible for us. We're sitting here saying, look, it's us, them. We've got it, they don't. We have the truth, they don't have the truth. Well, how do you know that that is the case? Are you diligent in your search? Are you listening to what Stan has to say from the pulpit, or what the teacher has to say from the pulpit when the classes are being taught? Are you diligent when you are studying to ensure that you're not just accepting it because it's written in some book or some man that you trust says it or some woman you trust says it, but rather it is what the Bible actually teaches? One of the things to note with regard to this is that people can be easily persuaded to accept error. And one of the most important things that we can do as Christians is to help each other not to fall for that. One of the primary purposes of worship, the first day of the week assembly, and any other assembly that we have, or any other class that we come together for at any point in time during the week, is so that we might edify one another, build one another up. And in Ephesians chapter 4, the purpose of that is given is that we are no longer tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine, but instead, by every part supplying their help, being joined and knit together by whatever joint supplies, we are growing as a body for the edifying of itself in love. And so we grow stronger as a result of our efforts to teach each other, to check one another, to ensure that no one goes off the deep end. And if you're by yourself, there is that danger. I don't know how many times I've heard of preachers. One comes to mind who was a very good mentor of mine. I can't say a good friend because I was 11 and 12 years old, and he was a grown man. But I thought him a friend, certainly. And he was certainly a mentor of mine, a gospel preacher. Got in his study and began studying some denominational books and became a Calvinist. And he's reached the point to where now he's a libertine. Completely left the faith. First of all, went into denominationalism, and now he's just so off the plantation that it's not anywhere close to being anything that is acceptable. This individual I would have never thought, because he was so sound and so strong. But early on, when he began to see these things and think, okay, this may be right or this is right, he didn't go to anybody and say, tell me different. He kept it to himself until such time as he was ready to expose it. And by that time, when individuals said, no, you've got it wrong, and tried to reason with him, he didn't want to hear it. If he had just talked to individuals, perhaps that would have been avoided. So that's an important thing that we have. Have that awareness of the effectiveness of false religion to deceive not only those in the world, but deceive us as well, so that we don't allow that to happen. And then secondly, we need wisdom to know that a stand with God will ultimately gain victory. The devil cannot win. Because we are told that he who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. And we acknowledge and understand that's the case. Okay, so that gets us in my lesson to the characters and symbols in the book. Anybody have anything they want to add before we get to a discussion of the characters and symbols? Yes, Justin.
A lot of times when you're talking with somebody and you have a thought of, like, I don't know what else to say, right? I explained it. It seems so basic, but some of that comes from having grown up in it. And it's interesting to think about, you know, had I been born to people that weren't Christians, what would my journey have looked like? You know, even having a love for the truth, when would I have been exposed to the truth?
Yep.
What would the struggles have been? Past my preconceptions, what were the struggles I've been with my family and stuff like that. What it's talking about here in Revelation 13 is pretty profound. I mean, I think what they're trying to get to is you had Mount Carmel, right? And the false prophets trying to call on their God, and they're being mocked, and hey, scream louder, maybe he's asleep, stuff like that. And then the true God was called upon, and fire came down from heaven and it lapped up the wood, but it lapped up the water, and it lapped up the dust, and it lapped up everything. And now they're saying here, they're even going to be able to do that.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about that next week, last week, and I wanted to discuss it again a little bit more today. We get into the signs.
So you think about that in today's terms, right?
Right.
That's not going to happen. So you got the them and the us. Look at us here. Someone can come with something pretty convincing.
Yeah.
Someone can walk into this congregation with something pretty convincing and take some of us away. That's the option that's right here.
Yeah. That's very important for us. I would remind you of the text of Colossians. I like the headings in this, and you have used it for a number of occasions, dealing with the error that comes from men. Now, the headings are not inspired, but they're supplied in the New King James Bibles from the translators. And beginning in chapter 2, it says in verses 1 through 10, not philosophy, but Christ. And then verses 11 through 23, not legalism, but Christ. And then in chapter 3 and going down through verse 11, not carnality, but Christ. And basically it's a three-pronged thing that Paul is warning about, is that it is possible for someone to come in and using these great swelling words, as Peter said in 2 Peter chapter 2, or in using this philosophy to deceive the elect. It's possible for these things to happen. And you're right. I mean, the idea of sophistry, the idea of human wisdom, Satan makes those things very appealing. All you have to do is go to the temptation of Christ in the wilderness, and you see how effective Satan can be. Now, Jesus was prepared to deal with it, but how easily it could be for some of us, if we're not careful, to be overcome by that philosophy, by that error, by that religious viewpoint, if we're not discerning. And that's why we need each other, and that's why we need to be diligent in our study, because they can truly be very convincing. And it's not only religious error either, by the way. I know of two young people. One was a member of this congregation, but two young men who have become atheists in their thinking because they got on YouTube and they started listening to humanists and evolutionists and looking into those kinds of things, and all of that led them to lose their faith. And again, it's one of those things where they didn't tell anybody until their faith was gone, and then when you try to talk with them, it's too late. It's a shame, but those kinds of things can happen, and we need to be aware of it and prepare for it. Thank you, Justin, for that comment. Anybody else? All right, so let us now then get into the next slide, which is the character and symbols, which we don't have very many in the list this time. And we've already discussed some of it in some detail, so we'll try to go over these things fairly quickly. First of all, again, we want to note the beast of the earth and the description given of the beast of the earth. It's not as extensive as it was from the beast of the sea. But as noted before in chapter 16, 19, and 20, there is another name that is given. It is the way to which we refer to this beast from now on. It will be a reference in the text as the false prophet. He has a supportive role to the beast from the sea, which is the political or secular power. Notice in chapter 13 and verse 12, he says he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence. So the authority the first beast has, the second beast has as well, perhaps given to him by the second beast, or more probably the idea is the origin from Satan, the dragon that gives this authority, supplies it to the second beast as well. And he causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. So the second beast, his purpose, his work, his efforts cause the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast. So he has the backing of the beast from the sea. They work together. And he exercises all the authority that the first beast exercised. So these are companion evil beings doing the bidding of the dragon who's come down on earth, knowing that he has a short time to oppress men and to oppress the people of God. All of these things that we've seen in the image of the dragon and the woman and the child and the efforts of the dragon to devour the child, these things that are coming out as they are witnessed with regard to the earth and what's happening on the earth are seen with regard to this secular power and this religious power that strives to deceive the world and to oppress, persecute, destroy the righteous. And these are very influential, very powerful. One of the things to keep in mind, because we see this, and actually, I suppose that it's possible for us to kind of feel perhaps the way they did in the first century. I've talked with individuals with regard to the philosophical aspect of this. We'll say the religious part, the beast of the beast from the earth and what he does, is that how do we know that we're the ones that are right? I've had young people who are raised in the church that have asked me this question. How do we know that we're the ones right? How am I supposed to stand against my professors, for example? I mean, when we talk about evolution, we've got all these professors in the colleges that have all of these letters after their names, and they talk about things and they go into depth of where I'm completely lost and don't know what's going on. And you're telling me that you as an ignorant preacher, you know more than they do, or that we as these simple people in the pews that we're right and they're wrong about the origin of life. All of those kinds of things. And you have people that do that. The educated. Let's talk about the religious era. You have preachers that become preachers. Just take me as an example. I don't have a degree in Bible. I didn't ever go to a seminary. I didn't even go to Florida College or any college to get my learning concerning religious matters from a college. I've just studied the Word. I've got my books and I've got the efforts. I've got my experience and those kinds of things. But how does that stand up against a seminary degree where you've got smart people with a lot of letters past their name teaching other smart people who get letters after their name and go out? Who's to say you're right and they're wrong? And we have that kind of sometimes can have that kind of a, I don't know if it's a confidence lack, a lack of confidence, a feeling of inferiority with regard to those things. But if we understand and recognize that these great powers have always existed and the people of God have always been in the minority, and you look at the first century as an example where the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the religious leaders of the Jews, rejected the Christ, but the common people heard him gladly. It's not a matter of how much you know. It's a matter of your approach to truth. It's a matter of your willingness to open your mind and heart and accept what is said. And I've even come across gospel preachers who have had more formal training that have cast aspersion upon the legitimacy of 2 Peter as a part of the New Testament canon, or the veracity of a particular passage of Scripture that has been taught for years and years as understood as truth based upon something that they learned and their higher learning, something that was not available to people in general. And we just have to understand and recognize that God is going to protect those who have an open heart, open mind, and are accepting of the truth of God. But this idea of learning, this idea of position, this idea of power, this idea of pervasiveness has absolutely no bearing on what's right and what's wrong. We've always been in the minority. We always will be in the minority, just as they were here in the first century. These beasts were powerful. These beasts held sway over the large majority of the world and had everyone in their thrall. But that doesn't mean they were right. And it never means that someone is right. And you can know the truth, and the truth can set you free if you'll open your hearts to it, just as Acts 17 and verse 11 tells us. Be noble, study the Word of God, come to an understanding of what truth is and accept it, and you will be right with God. I'll read you a text from Harkrider, commentary on Revelation concerning that beast from the earth, his description. He said, the vision John saw had an element that Daniel's description of the beast empires in Daniel chapter 2 didn't have. Because you'll remember the four empires there was speaking of the secular empires, the Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, the Alexandrian Empire, and then the Roman Empire. Whereas here, in this particular image, there is a religious aspect. Because the sea beast received worship from men. And he makes this point. When an empire is united with divine qualities, there emerges state religion, state worship. Nebuchadnezzar worshiped. The emperor is being worshiped. Pharaoh being worshiped. Here, in this case, of course, Harkrider takes the later date of writing. So he talks about the Roman Empire with its god Caesar have become precisely this kind of political entity. The two beasts are so intertwined that the false religion of the land beast was supported by the authority of the political power of the sea beast. And I just want you to get from that the nature of there's a word that's not coming to me about it, but it'll come later and I'll give it. But when they're working together in part, that sum total is something that's extremely powerful and extremely effective. And that's what they were up against in the first century. All right, with regard to that general idea of who the beast is or any identifying marks of him, we want to describe the two horns, which is another aspect of that. But other than that, anybody want to add anything to what we said with regard to the beast? All right, so with regard to the two horns that are stated in that particular text, two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. Interesting thing, when you say like a lamb, again, this is somewhat speculative, I suppose, but it's a legitimate point to make because it is borne out in this particular passage, is that you have religion, and a part of religion that people were familiar with, both in the Old Testament with regard to the animal sacrifices that were offered in the Old Law, as well as pagan sacrifices that would be offered, is that the lamb, a lamb was something that was commonly associated with religion. The firstborn lamb without spot or blemish was often utilized as a sacrifice in the worship that was offered up by the Jews, as well as the practice and the pagan practices as well of offering animal sacrifices. So the imagery would be something that would be perhaps effective to these Christians in the first century as they say, okay, this religious beast, this beast that has the religious aspect, has an appearance with two horns like a lamb. So there is at least a superficial appearance that would have an air of religiosity to it. Again, somewhat speculative. But I do want to note, with regard to that, the two horns like a lamb, that the lamb indeed was significant in regard to religion and sacrifice, but in this particular case, though he had two horns like a lamb, we are told that his voice was not like a lamb, was it? Because if you see the second part of that, he says that he had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. The words were like a dragon. And so with regard to that, you could talk about fierceness, you could talk about intimidation, you could talk about violence, but it seems like an obvious thing to bring about in regard to that is where his authority comes from. Who sent him? From whence does he get his power? He gets it from the dragon, which is identified as Satan. And so if you want contrast here. This is the way false religion is. It appears to be legitimate. It appears to be positive. It appears to be something that is beneficial. But the words, if the words are not true, if the words do not come from God, are destructive. And that certainly is the case in this particular passage. So if that has any significance with regard to the horns as being like a lamb, as being religious in appearance, I think that would be the application we would make. Questions, comments about the horns? All right, then the third thing in this is the deadly wound. The deadly wound that is referenced in chapter 13 and verse 3 has reference to the sea beast. And we've already spent a great deal of time in discussing this, so we won't cover that again. But you'll remember one of the seven heads of the sea beast was wounded in a mortal wound, though the sea beast survived. And there was speculation as to whether it might would have reference to, okay, you've got the world power, and maybe an emperor dies, but the death of the emperor doesn't change the fact that the world power remains in power, or that that because the emperor dies, the empire falls. But regardless, the point is this, that the sea beast remained alive despite the mortal wound to one of its heads. And the fact is, when you look at the remainder of the narrative, the sea beast is not overcome until such time as he is overcome by the Lord and cast into the lake of fire, as indicated in chapter 19. And so if there is any symbolism that would be that appeal to the people who were living at that time, they see some mortal wound suffered, they would know that that's not the end, that's not the fall, but that the fall would happen in God's time. So you'll notice chapter 19, verse 20, that we read earlier. We are told the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet who worked signs in his presence by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image, and the two were cast alive into the lake of fire burning with brimstone. So we'll get to the point. We'll read about that, and we'll come across that when we get to chapter 19. That's when the victory is assured and when the victory comes. All right, questions, comments? All right, then we get to those signs again. And I've already discussed this in general as well, but there are a couple of points that I want to make. Dennis referred to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 at the end of our time together last week. So I'd like to read that to you first of all. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 9. And make the point that at this point in time, both of which is referred to in 2 Thessalonians, as well as referred to in our text concerning what signs the beast from the earth was able to do. He was making fire come down from heaven, verse 13. That he was able to deceive, convincing the people to make an image to the beast, the power to breathe to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and to cause as many who would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Very influential, very convincing, and signs had a part to do with it. You'll notice that Paul referred to the coming of the lawless one. And I think that when we're talking about what was going on in the first century, at the latter part of that in Revelation, book of Revelation, we have a parallel to what Paul said was going to happen here in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 9. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, with all unrighteousness, unrighteous deception among those who perish because they did not receive the love of truth that they might be saved. And for this reason, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness. Now there's a point that we made in our discussion last time. We don't know. It's hard to determine the extent or the nature of these wonders that are mentioned in 2 Thessalonians 2, the signs that are mentioned in Revelation chapter 13, with regard to the extent of their power that is beyond the norm, the supernatural nature of what was going on. But I think it is important that we acknowledge that individuals who are put or who are deceived by this are culpable for their deception. Okay? So what is meant by that? Well, first of all, the word has been established. The signs that were needed to establish the truth have been offered to all mankind and have been recorded. We are told that the ultimate and final sign that was done on the part of Jesus was his resurrection from the dead. In Acts, the second chapter, the Apostle Peter came to the conclusion at the end of his gospel sermon that this Jesus whom you have crucified, God has made both Lord and Christ. The evidence of that was that he raised him from the dead. So that's the ultimate evidence that what Jesus said, and after him, those apostles, as they with signs and wonders proclaimed the gospel message, confirming the word that it came from the Spirit and from God, what they established was true. Okay? There is no reason, no justification to not believe the truth. The truth has ultimately been established. So whatever it was that the beast from the sea was doing, beast from the earth was doing to deceive, whatever he was capable of, how powerful he may have been, whatever these lying wonders are, they were not sufficient for God to say, well, they couldn't help it. It wasn't their fault that they were taken away in error. They were culpable because the truth has been established and they could know the truth if they desired it. Okay? So, there is a distinction that is made by, I'll just read a text from Harkrider. I've already made this distinction in our discussion last week. In the biblical sense, an authentic miracle is an observable act directly produced by God with means other than the physical laws of nature. He makes this statement. It is Satan could do the exact same thing. If Satan could do exactly what God did in performing those signs which established what was being said as truth, then there would not be a way to determine the true message of God from the devil's false words. So whatever signs that Satan has attempted to duplicate have been counterfeit. That doesn't mean that there are not supernatural abilities. It's just that they're counterfeit signs. We mentioned Acts 8 with regard to Simon the sorcerer. That he did great signs that convinced individuals that he was some great man and someone from God until Philip came and they saw the real thing. When Philip came, the Samaritan said, nope, Simon's not who has it, Philip has it. And Simon himself came to that same conclusion. We talked about Pharaoh, and we talked about the sorcerers that came that were able to turn their rods into serpents, just as Aaron when he threw his rod to the ground. But we also know that Aaron ate his rod, ate the serpents before becoming a rod again. His serpent ate the other serpents before coming again. There's a difference, and that difference is distinguishable. Now, I don't know. I really don't know the extent of these things. It's impressive what is stated in chapter 13, verses 11 and following, that as to what he could do, this beast from the earth, to deceive men. But there was no reason, no justification for anyone to reject the truth or to be deceived into thinking that what the beast of the earth had was true, because the truth had already been established by the divine wonders and signs that God had performed. Yes, sir?
We also have, Paul addresses this in Galatians 1, right? Even if an angel came down and told you something, you don't believe it if it doesn't match what you already know. It's true.
Yeah.
And so it's not just signs and wonders. You know, you see a magic act, you don't just go running after the magic act. And that's really what we're after. Focusing too much on the magic act, on the deceptive act.
Right.
Is
infertile. Yeah. So let's keep that in mind. That what happened was Jesus established himself from God with plenty. John 20 tells us there are many other things he did that could have been written, but these are written that you might believe. Jesus said, "I'm sending the Holy Spirit to guide you into all truth." Gave that to his apostles and the New Testament writers. Jesus in Matthew chapter 16 said that in order for you to establish your bona fides and that this is true, you are the ones that I'm giving this power, Mark 16, 18, giving you this power to go on with the signs that will follow after you to establish those things. So now someone comes in, Paul says later, who preaches something different. Don't believe it. And we'll say the same thing. I've used that very point with regard to the Book of Mormon. So you have the angel Moroni who comes in. And the angel Moroni brings these or tells Joseph Smith where to find these golden plates, gives him a seer stone that he put in his hat where he can look into his hat and he can interpret those golden plates. And now we have another gospel of Jesus Christ. And that's what they call it, another gospel of Jesus Christ. Paul said, if an angel from heaven, there's the angel Moroni, isn't it? If we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel than that which was preached to you, let him be accursed. So even if we were to accept the legitimacy that there was an angel that was appearing to Joseph Smith, it's a different gospel and it's one that we should not accept. That's the point that Aaron is making. So while, again, we do understand that there may have been some very powerful things going on here, truth has already been established, confirmed, and we know what it is, and that's what we hold to. And we don't allow ourselves to become deceived by those who are advocates and purveyors of error. Yes, Dennis?
Speaking to the nature of these things, we know certain things about Satan. That his abilities are very limited. The most powerful ability he has is to deceive. But he had to go before God in Job 1 and 2 just to get permission and the ability, temporary ability granted to him to even touch Job. So we know that there are things that he cannot do, and God for certain would never allow Satan to perform any kind of a sign or a miracle that would confirm error. He's not going to do that. So whatever it is that he gave him the ability to do here, if that, I think these are all just false signs.
Well, lying wonders, refer to lying wonders in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And again, whatever they are. And again, I mean, Simon the sorcerer, did he have any demonic power or not? But the fact is, he recognized and everybody else recognized that what he was doing and what Philip was doing is different. And then what Philip was doing from God, and which may have been by comparison. It may have been something that was extremely obvious. It's just something that we can only speculate on. But yeah, when you look at what Satan has to offer and what God has to offer, the genuine article is always obvious. And we need to note that that's the case. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention at this point. We'll talk about the image of the beast and the mark and the number. And then we'll get into the 14th chapter next time. So be ready. I'm not going to be here next Sunday. Aaron is teaching the class. And I think on the book of Joshua is what he's intending. Or the character of Joshua, one of the two. And so it'll be 2 weeks before we'll pick up with the end of this. Talking about the mark of the beast. And then get into the 14th chapter. All right. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention.